Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Andy DeLallo, and joining me on the program today is guest Yancey Strickler. Yancey Strickler is a writer, entrepreneur, and visionary thinker dedicated to redefining creative ecosystems. Best known as the co-founder and former CEO of Kickstarter, Yancey has been instrumental in empowering creative communities and imagining new ways to support and value artistic endeavors. He is currently the co-founder and director of MetaLabel, a platform that fosters collective creative expression and meaningful collaboration among artists. Yancey authored This Could Be Our Future, a manifesto for a more generous world, where he challenges the dominance of profit-driven thinking. In the book, he introduces Bentoism, a decision-making framework that encourages individuals and organizations to consider broader, long-term impacts beyond immediate self-interest. Beginning his career as a music journalist for publications such as Pitchfork, Spin, and The Village Voice, Yancey has a deep connection to culture and community. He co-founded the Creative Independent, an artist resource that provides emotional and practical guidance for creative people. Born and raised on a farm in Clover Hollow, Virginia, Yancey now resides in New York City, where he continues to pioneer ideas that challenge conventional thinking and inspire collective action. Okay, welcome to Looks Like New. Yancey, it's wonderful to have you here. Really, really excited to chat with you. And thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So I wanted to start out with a little bit of personal context. We've never met before. This is our first time meeting, and just kind of how I was introduced to your work and kind of where I'm coming from here. So last year I graduated with an MFA in art practice from CU Boulder. And towards the end of my time in the program, a friend of mine told me about New Models and Do Not Research. And these communities really opened me up to a new language and context for making meaning out of larger cultural shifts that are happening right now. And it was something that I just unfortunately didn't really get in the traditional academic context. The discussions on the podcast and in the Discord channels felt so rich and relevant. And it's where I first encountered your work. And this experience is what I later came to understand as the dark forest, moving into spaces for dialogue off the clear net, away from bots, trolls, ads, and the noise of mainstream social platforms. And so the framework for that idea started in 2019. This was 2 years after you stepped down as the CEO of Kickstarter. You put out an essay titled The Dark Forest Theory of the Internet. And this kind of sparked a wave of activity from various writers and thinkers, culminating in a collection of essays published last spring. I have my book here. And Nathan Schneider, who leads the Med Lab here in Boulder, is interviewed in the book, right? So it kind of brought me full circle, and I was like, oh, here, this is in Boulder, and now I'm involved in Med Lab as a non-student community member. And so I'm curious about, I would love to hear you talk about your journey from Kickstarter into the dark forest, and why that idea feels so relevant right now.
Well, thank you for that. Wonderful context. I appreciate it. Well, I would say I am someone who, part of me grew up on the internet. At an older age than is typical now, I was, I think, 13 or 14 years old when the internet was first happening. It's like 93, 94. I initially used the internet to join message boards for tape trading. I collected Oasis bootlegs, and there was a culture of, you could send someone a blank cassette, they would send you back something. And so I was a message board person in the 90s and all through the 2000s. And then social media happened, and conversations that had always been within opt-in communities that might be random, you know, people who collect DVDs, people who are music journalists, people who live in a certain neighborhood in Brooklyn. You would talk about politics, you'd talk about anything, your personal life, anything. They're just like a type of a neighbor. And that was how I always interacted online. And I had a blog. Many of those people also had blogs. People like Mark Fisher is part of that group. And, you know, it's just like a internet community, early internet community. You know, two things really changed that. One is, the biggest is social media, just shifting to feeds. The shift to feed is a UI versus, say, an RSS feed is slightly different than like an algorithmic feed or timeline. So those things really changed a lot. And then for me personally, making Kickstarter made it so that I had to think about, I represented a brand, a project. And so I couldn't act as just me. There were like business interests I had to be responsible for. I think that I thought that was true of, like, especially true of me as a founder, CEO of a prominent project. What I now realize is that's true of all of us. That's true of all of us. It's our jobs that we have to think about if we're not anon. You know, it's the implications of saying the wrong thing, getting canceled, getting bullied. And there was just a shift because, in part, the internet had become real life and had become the center of the world. So it wasn't just something that happened somewhere else. It was something that was a part of everywhere that you were. And we were just watching, you know, and many times, you know, seemingly deserving based on some cultural value at the moment, but we were watching people get ripped down from the pack like hyenas in some like David Attenborough video or something. And it created a chilling effect on everybody. And I think the truth is that maybe these sorts of more private opt-in spaces are the more natural habitat of the web. And that the social media era of especially 2010 to 2020 might be a blip. You know, maybe that's something that doesn't come back in the same way again. It's possible. And also that, even though I wrote The Dark Forest reflecting on my own experience and like why I had retreated, in the piece I talk about how I think it's possibly problematic. And I would say I now view it as like almost certainly problematic. But yet also totally understandable, and I know why we do it. I know why we do it. You don't want to be in the firing line. You don't want to fight for things every day. You just want to live your life. The internet's not your world, you know. But what happens is that these shared spaces, the clear nets, become dominated by people who are comfortable using them to seek power and control. And undoubtedly, those spaces shape us because we all still lurk, or a lot of us still lurk. And so in effect, we are continuing to listen, but muting ourselves. And yeah, I think that's problematic. It's a challenging dynamic that I think the 2024 election, you know, and what it feels like online is a part of, you know, and I think what the Trump years might feel like online might be an even more extreme version of this. And so I think that we will come to maybe see this as an issue. But I think it is a honest reaction to a scarring emotional experience or fears we have of being the one, being the zebra ripped down from the pack the next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I can understand the problematic aspect of it, but I think it's also, we have to kind of strike a balance in a way between the necessity of using these platforms, because it's like, it's, In your other book, actually, This Could Be Our Future, you talk about default, hidden defaults, and social media, like using these platforms, has become a default. You know, as an artist, you basically have to engage. It's almost like your LinkedIn page or something. You know, you have, this is what I do. It's my business card in a way, and so there's a obligation to engage to a certain extent, and I think that you're also part of a conversation in a way. By engaging too, you're contributing to a conversation. And yet at the same time, and you mentioned this, I feel like, throughout your work in many different ways, there's an emptiness too. There's a lack of intimacy in a way You know, like it's hard to find those deep, sustaining, rich connections with other people. And that's maybe where the dark forest can play in, you know, as a way to find those deeper connections, that deeper sense of intimacy, while still doing both in a way.
Yeah, I think there's a piece, the two pieces by Carly from New Models and Julian in the book, one about you won't find the counterculture on Instagram and the other about holographic media. You know, they really lay it out where the workflow, and I kind of have, I mean, honestly, I've had it today. I have my Telegram chat open on one side of my screen, or I'm chatting with Dark Forest, the Dark Forest collective chat. We're like working on some new ideas today and chatting with other people about things we're going to do. And in them, we're plotting. Plotting is a, gives it way more credit than it deserves, but plotting, you know, posts we're going to do and things we're going to make. And so we have this, you could think of it as a workspace, but it's also just a space where it's like we tap into each other. We tap into our collective intelligence. We know it's just us there. We know why we're there. And we also know that the ultimate intention of that is to manifest something in ClearNet. That way of working is powerful because that's how, in a very different way, but like that's how bot networks operate. That's how these agent accounts, AI accounts are going to be operating, you know? So it's, I think it ends up representing a type of a workflow toolkit. And that, I mean, that's like crypto conspiracy values. There's a lot of parts of the internet that are going to be like that. And it kind of leads you to think, you know, how much of what I see is like that, is something that was plotted and thought about and considered. And if we think about the conclusion I've reached is that social media, all social media is advertising. Everything I post is an advertisement, essentially. It's a very crass way of looking at it. There are people who are better than that or who are shit posters. And, you know, and those are the most interesting people. But by default, we're all little mid-twit, you know, trying to get our resume social cred points up each day. When we're all just making ads, you know, you just end up thinking about what happened to television. Then you have ad agencies and you have like 50 high paid people spending 6 months figuring out what they're going to show you in this 30-second ad where you're helpless, you know, popping chips into your mouth and you're just like, oh, I want to get a Mazda. You know, it's like that's what's going to be happening now on every post. I mean, I have a project now, MetaLabel, and like running a internet-based business or cultural product today is that every day you have to manufacture a new advertising campaign for what you're doing. Every single day. Every single day. And that is simply to be in the psychic space. Like you don't even necessarily get something out of that except that you exist. You exist. And so when like social currency and sense of self and status are determined that way. We know they're determined that way. We saw that Trump's popularity online was like more important than a Kamala celebrity endorsement. So it's just kind of like, I feel like we're being told how it works. It's happening around us. We are active participants. And I think that this is a way that can be quite successful. And so, yeah, so to say, like, there's a part of the Dark Forest story that's about retreat, which is an individual story. And I think that is valid. And like my group chats with my best friends from high school are my favorite places. You know, that's my hang. That's my hang because we live in different parts of the world. But that is a step one. But the step two is, you know, what do I care about or wish to influence, if at all? And, you know, dark forests, I think, are an effective way to do that. Mm-hmm.
And you brought up MetaLabel. And I would, let's talk about that a little bit here. So this collection, the Dark Forest Anthology of the Internet, was released on MetaLabel, a platform you co-founded and are the director of. Kind of tracing the history of it a little bit, as far as I understand, it was originally imagined as a project to explore the decentralized infrastructure of crypto and its wider possibilities beyond hyper-financialization. Is that correct
No.
Okay.
No. It started with, it started in a dark forest. It started with, I'd written This Could Be Our Future, and that kicked off this project of Bentoism and the Bento Society, which became a community of a few thousand people. And I was the community leader of that and was hosting sessions and teaching and doing a lot of things. And I found that work very rewarding in some ways because the people involved were amazing. But as a creative person, as an artist, I felt incredibly lonely and isolated. And I was at the top of this hierarchy. I was this guru in this group, you know, and I discovered that was actually quite boring for me and wasn't the type of exploration, you know, I was really looking for. And what I really longed for, I realized, were some peers, other people who would have better ideas or would count, you know, we'd bounce off each other and just like not just trying to manufacture everything on my own each day. And it just struck me that as a creative person, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to do that, actually. You know, it's like, am I supposed to start a band? Like, what is that? And so I ended up rereading a book I've always loved called Our Band Could Be Your Life, which is the story of punk rock and hardcore in the US. And it's like an oral history, kind of. And you learn about Black Flag, The Meat Puppets, Minor Threat, Sonic Youth, and how all of these were like making noisy, weird music that no record label wanted to put out. And so instead, they were forced to put themselves out. And to start a label then was like a P.O. box and a logo. And they would just issue their own record with money they'd saved up. But what inevitably happened is that before their first album even came out, there would be like three other bands that would show up and be like, can you put us out too? We make music like you. And suddenly Discord Records, which was created to put out the first Teen Idols record, like they had four more things they were putting out, and suddenly they were manufacturing this straight edge hardcore scene. And they were doing it because the label of Discord represented a style and also represented like a path where you could also become a part of that. And it made me realize how a grassroots indie label doesn't just put out music, it manifests more of it. Every punk record makes more punkness happen because people listen to it, they adopt a punk mindset, dress, they want to start their own bands. Like it's a flywheel, to use a Bezosian term. You know, it's a flywheel. And then I also was reading that week about the history of the Royal Society, which began in 1660 in England with a group of academics who were annoyed that back then all facts were determined by the church or by the king. And so they decided we should start a club that was about proving facts through evidence. And they gave themselves a motto of take nobody's word for it. And they started to figure out how would we do this. In about a year, they published the very first zine called Philosophical Transactions, in which they just had written pieces of them trying to conduct an experiment. And it was through these iterative pages over the next four centuries that the scientific method was created, peer review was invented, the Babbage machine, the first computer, was funded and presented, the first microscope, Benjamin Franklin's kite experiment, like Stephen Hawking, all these things debuted there. And this journal and this group represented a manifestation of a scientific worldview, of an Enlightenment worldview. And I came to see that Discord Records or SST or a punk label or Def Jam or Ruckus, a hip-hop label, that they and the Royal Society and a project like McSweeney's or a project like Mischief, they're all fundamentally doing the same thing. They're all a group of people with some worldview putting out work in a shared context. And so I just noticed that, wasn't sure if that was a new noticing or not, wrote up something about it, shared it with some friends I was thinking about with writing it, and everybody was just like, whoa, this is super interesting. Never thought about this, but never connected these dots before. That's compelling. And so the project just kept sort of pulling. And about a year later, I found myself collaborating with Rob Kalin, who started Etsy, with Austin Roby, who started Ampled, now Subvert, with two other friends, Ilya Yudinov, Anna Bulbrook, Lauren Dorman. And there's soon six of us who are all together and working on this idea of, like, we're going to reinvent the label for today. And we're going to make it so labels are something anyone can start. They are like shared economics. It's not about music. It's any type of creative output. And we're going to make that happen. We initially began with blockchains because we thought, like, oh, to do shared economics and all that, there's a great toolkit of a blockchain that makes sense to run that part of things. So we started with that for the economic side. Experimented with that, did something with MedLab around that, which went great. A lot of great projects last year. But ultimately felt that the work was not about blockchains. The work was about this format and that blockchains were getting in the way of that. Mm-hmm. And so last year we developed a way to create payment splits, to create shared treasuries and recreate shared financial infrastructure in a fundamentally new way using Stripe and traditional bank accounts. And so today on MetaLabel, anyone can drop a release. They can form a label or group with other people, release work together on their own, one by one, just like Discord, just like the Royal Society. Anything they sell, you set a split from the beginning to say on a percentage basis how much money goes to everybody. You can build a treasury of money you can share. And all of that has gone live gradually over the course of this year. And then we really opened our doors in a more significant way just last month in October. And last October we had, or this few weeks ago, Brian Eno published a new book with us, an artist edition of a book called What Art Does. That's phenomenal. Groups like Rhizome, people like Mindy Sue, Chantel Martin, the Dark Forest Collective, lots of great releases putting out work with us. And so we are, it's an ambitious project that ultimately is speaking to, I think, three things. Number one, that creative work is more valuable than it's given credit for. So MetaLabel is a space that really elevates it. You can make anything collectible, purchasable. It's like meant to make your work feel legitimate. Creative people don't have to feel alone. You could be a part of something bigger than you. That is the feeling I was always looking for, and that everything about this project has fulfilled for me. And that last, that like shared upside, passive income, royalties from creative work can happen for anybody. And MetaLabel makes that possible. Like any type of artist can receive a royalty, passive income, upside. Like that just hasn't been possible before. And so hopefully that set of things is compelling and leads to new outcomes. And we have a very long-term vision that extends from that, but that's where it begins. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've actually really respected about your approach to this project is actually, you know, I mentioned crypto earlier, but maybe it's, you know, blockchain, like you were saying. But I actually just appreciate the transparency that you've brought to those explorations. Like, you've written about this extensively in terms of kind of going into those spaces, what can we take from the promise of those technologies in a lot of ways, or the potential of those technologies. In your essay, After Crypto, you mentioned three good primitives coming out of the space: the decline of platform lock-in, distributing ownership and influence outside of an organization, and permanent agnostic archiving. And then a year or so later, you were climbing out of the rabbit hole and going on a crypto cleanse. And so you kind of trace some of that journey already with what you just described with MetaLabel, but I guess maybe more specifically, like what are the lessons learned from that? You said blockchain sort of got in the way of what the aim of the project was. If you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of it is timing. Long-term, I'm still a believer and I still follow the space and respect the things people are doing. I stay in touch, like haven't left, not active, but haven't left. And But I think that, you know, there are projects that are, at the beginning of the internet, it was like everything was an e-commerce site rather than its own thing. Like, you were defined by the category and you were subservient to the category. So the category, the major was e-commerce and the minor was like, it's for books and you're Amazon or something. And I think that crypto is a very dominant major. The projects that use it, well, really embrace it, and as they should. But really the people who are there are because of that. And whatever your minor is like totally subservient to that dominant narrative of crypto. And so maybe that supports you if you're a certain type of project, or maybe it scares people away if you're something else. And I think that the general public's like radar, you know, in terms of like what becomes popular, what doesn't, I think it's generally like quite truthful and reveals a lot of stated preferences or unstated preferences. And I think that what is revealed is that people are excited about the potential of a more democratic way to get rich. And democratic is a fuzzy term, but just, yeah, it kind of is. It's pretty wide open. It's pretty wide open. The SEC, you know, has issues with that, but like it is wide open. And that, how many parts of our world are really wide open anymore? You know, I hear like my parents talk about what it was like to drive in the 50s and 60s, and it's just like, no laws, you know, do whatever. And it's like, that's what it's like. And so that I think is exciting. It's absolutely exciting. And I totally get it. Totally get it. The idea that like we should all care about our things being stored in this space, and that, you know, and that we're going to be somehow liberated by these things, and just all the grandiose promises, I think never stuck with people, always struck people as like, that smells like some, and I think it largely is. And so, you know, the truth that has shaken out in the space the last year is that it is about money and speculation. It's really not about much more than that. There are wider implications as that becomes normalized. Stripe acquiring a stablecoin provider is a really big deal. And I can see all the ways that that plays out. And I would expect that Metalabel and crypto will converge again in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we architected our system in such a way that we could choose to do that if we wish, because we adopted post-platform principles. All those things are inherent in what we've made. So I think that, I mean, my true crypto theory is that, you know, the scene has elected government leaders and will continue to, that will intentionally limit and dismantle the state in such a way that will provide need for things like network states or internet-based means of survival, and that ultimately these things do lead to the decline of the nation state. And I think that that's, the period from like the French Revolution in 1789 to 2020, maybe it's COVID, to 2020, 2016 even, that is a distinct era. And that this is a different era, and that dark forests, crypto, post-individual identities, all these things are going to converge. You know, I've long had this question of like, in the future, will there be 4 nations or 4 million nations? And I think it's clearly 4 million, and maybe only like 7 will matter in a real way. But I think that's the future we are moving towards. I do think crypto is a part of it. I think that aspects of that are going to be pretty dystopian. I think aspects of that are going to be pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
What are those aspects happening right now and kind of this convergence you're talking about is blue sky, really, in a lot of ways. So as you probably know, it's built also on this promise of decentralization. And kind of as a... on a surface level, it's a replacement of Twitter, a short form text-based posting. But on the deeper level, this idea of decentralization means that you can have more ownership over your data, more choice in the algorithms behind the content you see. And since post-election, it's crossed something like 20 million users just the other day in an exodus from Twitter or X, and fueled by the, I think, by the election and some of the sentiment around that, but then also these new terms of service agreement from X that says anyone can be removed for any reason at any time. Well, actually for no reason at any time. And that by using the platform, all your data can be analyzed for AI purposes, for AI training. Talking about that platform lock-in and things like that. And so one blogger, Austin Parker, puts it, the team at Blue Sky has managed to wrest a singly generally applicable use case from the morass of crypto BS that spawned it. And now, though, so there's, you know, that promise building off of that promise of potential of decentralization. But now it's funded by blockchain capital. States it will not be using blockchains, but it's just received a bunch of funding in that regard. And, you know, that kind of makes me think of that convergence you're talking about to a certain extent. And it brings up the question, what do you think about this scalability of these types of platforms building in this direction as they start to hit this kind of mass adoption curve away from these mainstream social media platforms?
Yeah, we're big fans of the, I believe it's the AT protocol that underlies Blue Sky. And there is a protocol that is underlying MetaLabel that we haven't publicized or productized anyway yet, but it's very inspired by that data model. And we use the decentralized identifier format, which is basically an open phone book that makes all data referenceable to other places. So every user account on MetaLabel has a DID, every piece of content, every label, and it ultimately allows all of those things to be fully portable around the web. Download, export, run offline, run on your computer, put on your own server. All of those things are in the future for us. And I think those are like, that's what we all want. Give us the cake and let us, whatever, I'm going to butcher with some metaphor by trying to make it more active. But, you know, it's like, we want to be able to have the benefits of network effects, but we also want to be able to own and control what we feel is ours. And I think that these structures absolutely fulfill that. And I think will be normalized and can and will be default probably for new things. It's going to be hard for old things to evolve over to this, and they may not have to. You know, Amazon's, however many people have an Amazon account, is a lot more valuable than a wallet address. I'm sure they'll add those things the second they feel like it's profitable. You know, I think the fact that Blue Sky, which I think has always held very intentionally and for good reason, held crypto at arm's length. I don't know anything about anyone involved in these things, but to me that suggests that traditional VCs not as interested, not offering the terms that probably they wished, probably a little more like, how are you going to make money off this? What's the ad revenue model? How are you charging? You know, probably driving on that front. Whereas a crypto investor, they honestly will be more mission aligned. Because a crypto investor, not uniformly, but a crypto investor there is going to be more, I think, more ideologically motivated by the goals of the project versus how can you make this a good business, son? You know, and so what that reflects in the future, I mean, all that comes down to other elements of control and what sort of structures they created. I don't think it means anything specific about the future, but I think it represents who believes in a decentralized future, who believes that's actually important. And yeah, it's going to be people who have been indoctrinated with, you know, the Ethereum values, which I think are really positive. You know, I think it's I like that vision. I like that vision. And yeah, so I think that's, honestly, things are moving in that direction more than I would have expected. And I think for a multitude of different reasons, I think the second Trump term will be a huge driver, just as the first was like a dismantling to a certain era of the internet. I think the second is going to kick off the start of the next era.
And part of this next era you've been very focused on it at MetaLabel, I feel like, in the things you're putting out. Like one quote from Blue Sky, actually, MetaLabel and Blue Sky, defines itself as a new operating system for creative people. And this is also what I see as a common theme throughout your work, imagining new institutions to meet the demands of an evolution in what it means to be an individual. You term this evolution post-individualism, which tries to express the ways computers and the web have changed our sense of self and how society is changing in response. And in your essay, The Post-Individual, you put language and context around some of these changes that we sort of just sense and feel right now. And you're talking about it right now about how it's like so much change. We can't really, we're just attempting to put language around this and kind of a framework around this, but it's really just happening so fast that this is still a really useful framework, I think, post-individualism. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate more on that and these like, you know, potentially new institutions emerging around this sense of self.
I really appreciate that thoughtful observation. You know, I think saying like my work is exploring what it means to be an individual in different ways or in how an institution and individuals relate, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And there's two other projects I won't talk about today, but will come out next year that are really that at an even bigger level that I hadn't even connected before. I think I'm cursed with a lot of self-awareness, not always right, but I sense it, and I get frustrated with myself. And it's in the course of getting frustrated with myself, I get angry, I'm like, need to figure it out, I chew on it, it eats me up, and then I like come to understand something, some way of like, oh, I think this is what's going on with me. And when I do that, I tend to write about it. And what I'm really writing about is just like what I'm figuring out by looking inside of me. And how is all that I'm taking in and what I'm pushing, like what is, there just are moments where I'm like, what is it that I'm doing exactly? And they come out in feelings. It's just a feeling. And I've learned to trust feelings more than anything else. Like, why do I feel afraid to be myself? Why don't I know where to go to feel more connected? Like, and I just try to unpack those things. And all of that has led me to see the act of going online as being an act of individuation. That if when I was 12 years old and going onto some message board to get an Oasis bootleg cassette, and I'm creating my screen name, which was not, I remember my screen, it was not my name, my actual name. And, you know, that choice of like, yeah, that choice of my screen name is like, yeah, I chose the name of a character I wrote about in little science fiction stories for myself. And I thought, ah, that's who I am here. I'm a little explorer. I never thought about this before. But like, that was a separation. That was like a step into a forest, right? And donning something. And that is a really meaningful act. And it's a meaningful act because it establishes an identity for yourself that is separate from what you look like, where you live, who your family is. It's a totally new identity. That what's happening on the internet, and that's a process we repeat all the time. And we know this, like the old Dolly Parton memes about like your LinkedIn version of yourself, your YouTube, your OnlyFans, your whatever, right? Like everyone on OnlyFans probably has a LinkedIn too that are totally disconnected, you know, but it's the same person. And that what's happening online is that all of our inner selves, those slices of self, are meeting the slices of self of other people. And we are making new societies within the web. In The Post-Individual, I connect this with a bunch of reading I'd done about where individualism comes from. not a natural occurring concept, something that really was developed. And it happened around the year 1000 in Southern Europe, where at the time people lived in familial clans. And what tended to happen in those clans was that cousins were married to each other. You kept like the bloodline secure. And around 1000 AD, for whatever reason, the Catholic Church decided it wanted to dismantle the power of these clans. And someone had the idea of we should prohibit cousin marriage. You're no longer allowed to marry your first cousin. If you marry your first cousin, you're excommunicated from the church. Some local papal officials announced this, and that custom began to grow. And what happened was that suddenly, young people looking to marry in these clans needed to meet people from other clans. And this real tribal structure of society began to break down. And what emerged within 100 years of the prohibition of cousin marriage were cities in a big way for the first time. There had been a few cities before, but they were tiny and there weren't that many of them. But cities really took off. Guilds became invented, and the university became invented, all within 100 years of cousin marriage and being prohibited. Because I believe what happened is that these newly liberated individuals went together to towns and trading posts to meet other people and, okay, we got to do this thing, and likely discovered, oh, this is really hard without a shared context. This is dangerous. How do I know who to trust? Like, this is a scary world. It's exciting, but it's scary. And what they created were the institutions of the city, the university, the guild, structured pathways where people could meet each other, make a living, things that we still rely on today. And I believe all those were a direct, and not me, but like academics have written multiple books about how those things are very interrelated. And so what I think the internet is doing is the internet is reindividualizing us, just like that, 16-year-old boy or girl leaving their family in southern Germany, 1,000+ years ago. When we go online, that's what we're doing. And there's a thrill of excitement, but we also meet some dangerous characters that red pill us or whatever. And we learn that we need shared context and we need the safety of others. And that what is happening right now on the internet is that we are building iteratively the institutions of the future. Those institutions were created 1,000 years ago when the nature of what it was to be a person changed. The world has largely run on those institutions ever since. The internet marks a significant change of what it means to be a human being. And the things that we're doing now, things we've been talking about, dark forests, even crypto, like all of these things, I think are a part of the puzzle of really what might be the next 1,000 years. And that, power has moved to the web. That's only going to accelerate. And so then the space we all navigate is one in which we all carry multiple inner identities and selves that are alive and that are interacting with the inner identities and selves of others on the internet and manifesting new realities that have no connection to the physical world. And all of these things are so powerful, they are overtaking the world that first birthed them. And it's going to produce a new set of institutions, and it's producing a very different lived experience where surveys show that millennials and below, the vast majority say they are more themselves online than offline. Gen X is about 50-50. Boomers, it's like 90% more themselves offline, 10% online. For the youngest generation, for Alpha, I guess it's called, it's like 70% most themselves online. And that is the future. Those are the elders of 50 years from now. That is the world 50 years from now. And I think it's all happening for reasons that are consistent with ancestors 1,000 years ago in some like very basic ways. So the post-individual piece I worked on for many years, trying to explore this idea and just something I don't know, just trying to understand what I felt was happening to and around me and just trying to articulate it.
And these new institutions you're talking about that are emerging, you know, it's messy and we're still figuring it out. It's still so many unknowns. But we certainly have a pretty good idea. We can at least trace a lot of the defaults we live in now and kind of where they come from. In your book, This Could Be Our Future, the whole first part of it, essentially, is basically tracing the rise of neoliberalism and how financial maximalization became the core value of business and become the default mode for society at large. And you talk about how this this created like a progressively globalized and flattened monoculture that's lonely. And it created so much loneliness and isolation. And you mentioned earlier, described starting MetaLabel out of this sense of loneliness you felt as a creative person. And that even though you might have thousands of followers, you still lacked creative peers to collaborate with in a deeper way, that intimacy you were talking about earlier. So this hidden default, financial maximalization and all that, the institutions that have kind of come around that, is fundamental to the attention economy that's still dominating the online spaces where younger generations feel most themselves. And my question for you is, what brings you hope and kind of urges you to keep cultivating a more generous world? That's one thing I take away from your work. It's very optimistic. At least that's my takeaway. And what would you say to those young people feeling that loneliness in the world they're inheriting?
Yeah, I'm extremely hopeful. I'm really not pessimistic. I mean, I'm pessimistic about the future of some things, but not the future overall. Maybe I project onto others and to society at large my emotional journey when I go through hardship, which is it's probably stages of grief, kind of where like I first retreat, I get angry at myself, I don't listen, but ultimately I feel compelled and forced to take action and to change the situation. And I believe very much in the human capacity to do that. I think that it's happened over and over and over and over and over again. And humans are infinitely adaptable. And the way we prioritize our now versus every other now is ridiculous. Yeah, I just have faith in the continued project of life. Because life is, you know, the miracle of the world is that it's all set to just flow by everyone, by truly self-interest, a type of self-interest, not the self-interest we talk about, but it's meant to flow through the needs for survival, the needs for love, and the world works in such a way that actually if everyone did that, the world would be incredible. It would be incredible. If you do that without, you know, infringing, if you do that without, you know, within certain bounds that can be non-restrictive and can be pro-social. And, you know, there's like, I believe that. I also believe that there is no perfect world and that like inside of us is all of these things. Like everything contains everything. And so like, I can't say if only we didn't have that, because that is also a part of who I am and who we all are. So I just think, I just put faith in the oneness. And I believe the oneness is real. And I think that, like, especially people on the left, we get ourselves worked up about problematizing everything and just ruining everything for, in some cases, super legit. In other cases, like, such marginal things. So marginal. Big picture, so marginal. But for sure, the internet is net a massive force for good. For sure, these are things that produce more enlightenment, you know, ultimately. Maybe that's a foolish belief, but like, I think memes, you know, contain a lot of truth. So I guess I'm just, I don't know, like I'm in the navel of the oneness. I'm just a part of it. I'm looking out and I'm looking around and I'm like, whatever it is I'm a part of, I surrender to it. I surrendered to it, and I love it, and I love the world around me, and I believe in that. I believe that that is the driving force of the universe, and there's work, a lot of work to be done to center that more, to let that flow more, and that's the things that frustrate me, where we lose sight of that because we chase certain status goals. And when I say we, I mean me, you know, and that, you know, the ultimate truth, the salvation, it's always right there. It's inside of you. It's always like a deep breath away. It is there. And we get ourselves really worked up by fears and worries that are beyond us, and to where we don't really see what's going on. And I'm not saying I see what's going on, but I just sense that, like, yeah, I don't know. I don't like how I'm answering this question, except, yeah, I'm just really trying to show real respect to what I think the universe is about.
And I think that
it sounds ridiculous, but it's true. I don't know. Well, it's what I believe.
And I think that, again, in a lot of your writing, you're very clear about taking the long-term view, both in the past and in the future. You know, like zooming out and thinking things across these wider arcs. I think it is hopeful to look at that rather than maybe what you might be immediately faced with in any given moment. And it's not great a lot of times, you know, and it's hard not to be overcome with that, for sure. You know,
just look at, it's an obvious point, but just look at the world around you and ask yourself, how much of this did I have to do with? How much of the world around me did I help create? Do I have any hand in? Do I feel like, you know, what's the fact? Like, for almost all of us, it's almost zero. It's almost zero. We're living in someone else's house and being like, I don't like the curtains, and I think this is annoying, and whatever. And it's like, yeah, we're part of a long process, and we think we made up the whole fucking game, you know. And it's just a little silly. It's a little silly.
Well, to kind of wrap things up here a little bit, do you have any, are there any upcoming projects or essays that you have on the horizon that we should be, stay tuned for?
Yeah, I made a big, vague, hopefully intriguing reference. But yeah, I have another book in the works that will be coming out, I think, early in the new year. One written by me about, it's called Creativity After Art, and it's a new history that I think people will be pretty shocked by. So that's been a fun, really fun project. There's also a book, the Dark Forest Collective will have a new book that we're announcing next month, written by the incredible Nadia Asparova, author of Working in Public, a great Stripe Press book about open source software. I won't say what her book is about, but it's incredible. Amazing second release from the Dark Forest Collective. Better than our first release. It's total. I'm still thinking about it. It's phenomenal. And then, yeah, next year, you know, Meta Label is could not be more ambitious. And next year we'll announce a new release project that really speaks to redefining how individuals and organizations relate to each other, and just what the future of culture in the world looks like. And so there's something we've been working on that we'll begin to talk about, that we're, yeah, very excited about. And so, yeah, just, you know, we're just a small group of people just obsessed with this question, these questions, how to feel more together, how to make things that reflect what we really believe in, you know, how to help more people have that sense of being a part of something bigger than them. And there's a lot that could be so much better about what we're doing, but that, you know, that's what we're fired up about. And so, yeah, hopefully people will like the things we'll have to share.
That sounds incredible, and I'm really looking forward to checking all that stuff out. You know, I'll be definitely stay tuned with everything Meta Label's doing, with your work as well. I'm a big fan. So yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today, and great conversation.
appreciate your thoughtful questions.
You have been listening to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology. Looks Like New comes to you from the Media and Economies Design Lab at University of Colorado Boulder. You can find us on the airwaves across Colorado's Front Range, on KGNU Community Radio, on the fourth Thursday of every month, and online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month.